bigot is, I think, I'm sorry to say it, but I think that's kind of more American colonialism. Like, we don't actually have that kind of power. We can help them try to win. And that is, you know, on this analysis, that's the best way to try to end this war. Because as we have seen in Bucha and Irpin and Trostianyats and Mariupol and everywhere that the Russians have occupied, they really are carrying out a war in which they are executing local civic leaders, executing men of military age, sending men and women, they on their own statistics, more than a million people, sorry, probably predominantly women and children, to Russia, so they will never be Ukrainian again. They're carrying out this war on according to principles which Ukrainians see every day and recognize. Therefore, you know, if it's a colonial war, even if we could get the Ukrainians to capitulate, which,
Tim,
as I say,
they seconds.
Okay, but if they did, all you would see would be the continued colonial genocide of Ukrainians. So I just can't see that something to be wished for.
Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University. His books include Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, and a revised version has just come out. Also author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. A belated happy birthday to Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is an immediate opening for a news writer-producer. Go to democracynow.org, apply immediately. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual spring membership drive. You can help us meet our $56,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $12,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, reaction is coming in fast and furious in Oregon and across the country as Roe v. Wade appears threatened by the U.S. Supreme Court. Hundreds of Portland nurses vote to go on strike, saying they need PPE guarantees. And a couple of Oregon high schools are in jeopardy. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 5th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. A majority of some 1,600 nurses in Oregon vote to go on strike. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade is covering the story.
Nurses at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center have voted to authorize a strike on Wednesday evening, according to the Oregon Nurses Association, in a nearly unanimous decision. Spokespeople from the ONA say the vote to strike is to protest Providence's, quote, illegal and unfair labor practices and demand a fair contract to raise nurse standards, end quote. For more than 7 months, Providence has been in negotiations with the ONA with attempts to deliver a comprehensive pay and benefits package while addressing staffing protocols, improving patient care, making healthcare more affordable for both patients and nurses, and tackling Providence's growing staffing crisis. The hospital is criticizing the vote, touting it as a move to delay, quote, meaningful discussion, citing the union's rejection of the hospital's offer to involve a neutral federal mediator in hopes of accelerating negotiations. An overwhelming majority of the 1,600 frontline nurses working at Providence St. Vincent voted for the strike, and meetings have been set this week to prepare moving forward with that decision. According to the ONA, over the last several months, Providence has allowed nurse contracts to expire, forcing hundreds of frontline nurses to work without a contract during the COVID-19 pandemic. Major Oregon hospitals where nurse contracts have been allowed to expire include Providence St. Vincent, Providence Willamette Falls, and Providence Hood River, with expiring contracts this month at Providence Milwaukee and later this year at Providence Portland Medical Center. Bargaining sessions between the union and the hospital are set for Tuesday, May 10th and Monday, May 23rd. If the strike becomes official, ONA will give Providence a 10-day notice to allow management time to stop admissions and transfer patients unless the two sides can reach an agreement that would prevent a work stoppage. Both sides have maintained that patients' well-being comes first, but as ONA's executive committee president at St. Vincent, John Smeltzer, RN, said, quote, Providence is hemorrhaging nurses and staff. We can't wait and hope it gets better. We have to take action, end quote. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
A report released Wednesday has revealed startling rises in the Portland metro area's houseless population since 2019, when the count was postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The federally mandated count shows that since 2019, Multnomah County has seen more than 1,200 additional residents now facing houselessness. The Point in Time, or PIT, survey counted a total of 6,663 people living without a home as of January 26, 2022 in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, according to the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Multnomah County's findings are showing that of 2022's count of 5,228 houseless residents, more than 3,000 were unsheltered, 1,400 were in some form of shelter, and 685 were in transitional housing. People conducting the survey suggest these numbers may be even higher, as the pandemic placed unanticipated halts on the count due to quarantines and unexpected lack of staff during the duration of the survey. Another factor revealed in the count shows disproportionate rates of houselessness among people of color, with Multnomah County showing more than 40% of everyone counted were people of color. In hopes of addressing the alarming rise of houseless residents in Multnomah County, JOHS is requesting funds for 2,000 additional shelter beds that, coupled with COVID-related shelters and federal funding for safe rest villages, could provide more than 2,700 beds, nearly double what was available before the pandemic. Many working to assist the houseless community are saying they're not surprised by the high numbers, largely citing people underestimating the impact of COVID-19's economic fallout. Katrina Holland, executive director of JOIN, a homeless services agency in Portland, says the rising crisis is a symptom of a larger systemic problem. Holland and her team are pushing for Housing First initiatives, enacting programs to alert people of housing instability earlier in the process and to increase outreach and investments in affordable housing. Coinciding with economic strain brought about by the pandemic, Portland has seen some of the fastest spikes in home prices and rents nationwide, with a recent Redfin survey showing rent prices have soared in Portland roughly 40% higher than in March of 2021. The results of the PIT test will be reported to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and a full report will be released this summer. The Oregon School Activities Association puts two high schools on probation. With more on that story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
Oregon's Interscholastic Activity Authority has put two high schools on probation because of alleged racist behavior. The behavior was reported at two separate basketball games this winter. Clatskanie High School girls basketball players were said to have used racist language against members of the De La Salle team during a game last December. De La Salle is a Catholic high school. Fans at Molalla High allegedly wore blackface and taunted fans from Gladstone. One adult was said to have shown an image of a Confederate flag from their phone. The Oregon School Activities Association, OSAA, the statewide regulator of interscholastic sports in the state, hired a third-party investigator to look into the incidents, and it put both schools on probation. The schools can still compete, but another infraction could lead to suspension from competition. In addition, the schools must take steps to ensure future incidents won't occur, including offering training for students and staff on racial equity and implicit bias. OSAA Executive Director Peter Weber said the organization is focusing on educating young people in school communities, including schools that were put on probation. Weber said, if problems continue, there are more serious penalties. He said, quote, penalties certainly include probation. There could be appearances before our executive board, required plans of action, even things such as forfeitures or fines, lack of institutional control, all the way up to suspension of membership for the school or even expulsion from the association, end quote. There have been other publicized allegations of racist behavior at school competitions in recent months. Games in LeGrand and Camas, Washington have drawn complaints of racist behavior requiring investigation. Weber said he wasn't sure that such incidents were happening more frequently or if they are drawing more attention. He added, quote, "We're not naive to think these incidents have never taken place in the past and may take place in the future, and it's up to us to do our best to prevent those things and certainly address them when they occur. We are hearing more about them, which allows us to address those," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Officials and advocates across the country and here in Oregon are rallying for abortion access after a leaked draft from the U.S. Supreme Court shows a majority vote could overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling. Emily Scott tells us about a gathering at Independence Mall in Philadelphia.
Advocates from Planned Parenthood Pennsylvania and state officials gathered in Philadelphia on Wednesday to stand firm on protecting abortion access after a leaked draft indicates the U.S. Supreme Court could overturn its 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade. Pennsylvania has no laws protecting abortion access on the books, and Democratic Governor Tom Wolf has said he would veto any bill that restricts it. During a news briefing, Southeastern Pennsylvania Planned Parenthood President Dale Steinberg said, "It's important to remind people that abortions are still safe and legal right now.
We are fighting to ensure that everyone has the power to control their own bodies. We deserve elected officials at all levels of government who believe that as well. No judge and no politician should ever block your personal medical decisions or set the course for your life."
The Supreme Court decision won't be finalized until it's officially published, most likely in the next 2 months. A report found that if Roe v. Wade is overturned by the High Court, the number of people who may drive to Pennsylvania for an abortion would skyrocket by 1,000%. Some state lawmakers have introduced anti-abortion legislation, including Senate Bill 956, which proposes a constitutional amendment that would deny the right to abortion care. State Senator Amanda Cappelletti co-chairs the Women's Health Caucus. She says the draft decision is dangerous.
States that have restrictive abortion legislation have the highest rates of maternal mortality and morbidity. And here in Pennsylvania, we have high rates of maternal mortality and morbidity. If the legislature ever gets through more legislation that would restrict access, those numbers would go up.
Among Pennsylvania counties, 86% do not have an abortion provider. Wolf joined 16 other governors calling for immediate passage of the Women's Health Protection Act, which would protect access to abortion across the country. The bill passed the U.S. House of Representatives in September and awaits a vote in the Senate. I'm Emily Scott with Keystone State News Connection.
The draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court striking down the abortion rights guaranteed in Roe v. Wade has people fearing the conservative majority on the court could use the same logic to strike down LGBTQ, contraceptive, and other rights. Justice Samuel Alito wrote in his draft opinion that the right to abortion is not deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. I asked Oregon State University history professor Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols for his thoughts about that.
Right. Yeah. So historians are pretty unequivocal on this. You know, if you were studying for your PhD comprehensive exams like I did some years ago, you would have read the sources and the secondary sources about early America in particular. So the era of the founding. And it's very clear that before so-called quickening, when you can actually feel a baby, that women were taking abortifacients very regularly, and that was a part of life. And you know, there's a pretty simple way to understand that. If you look at the historical record, something like 1 out of 8 or 1 out of 7 women died in childbirth to start with. A woman's value, that life of that living human being who contributed to a farm, to a business, to a society, was far greater than an unborn child, particularly when they couldn't yet be felt. And so there was no sense, we have a sense now through medicine that there's something called early, you know, early fetal growth, right? We know that it's possible to have a child within us at certain weeks and months. We have timing for this. We've got timetables and schedules. Every expectant mother goes through all that. There was none of that then, right? And so in fact, you know, if you were having intercourse outside of marriage, if you had a whole lot of children, if you couldn't sustain them, it was just a very regular part of life. To have to take sorts of potions and herbal remedies Abortion was a, quote, option, as scholars have said regularly. Cornelia Hughes Dayton is one scholar who's written about this in a really important article called Taking the Trade, Abortion and Gender Relations in Early 18th Century New England Villages. It looks at all kinds of this stuff. And we've got these records, these diaries of midwives. So we know for sure that there is a long and deeply rooted tradition in the U.S. and in the West more broadly, in Europe as well, of having abortifacients as an option for women who were early term or just thought that they were. They didn't actually have to have been pregnant to have taken these. If they had a concern, they would take some of these remedies.
So on a scale of one, Alito's really super wrong about history, to 10, he's super right. Where would you rate him?
If it's 1 to 10, it's got to be a 1 there. I mean, I think every historian that I know who studies early America, or has taken these exams like I have, or who teaches the history of abortion, Roe v. Wade, individual rights and collective rights and responsibilities, history of medicine, we all pretty much have a consensus that the historical record suggests that there is no deeply rooted tradition against abortion in the way that we think of it today. And partly that's because the way we think of it today is fundamentally different from how they would have thought about it in the 18th or 19th centuries, that we have modern medicine, that we've got modern ultrasounds, we have all kinds of different things going on. So to say that there's an unbroken long tradition here is just incorrect.
Okay. And other protections that are grounded in the same constitutional right to privacy, there's a fear that, for example, gay marriage could be next on the chopping block, or the next pillars of the Federalist Society's goals, I guess, all along have, you know, could we also see contraceptive rights on the block too?
I think so. You know, I think what we're seeing here in this draft ruling and the majority opinion by Justice Alito is an assault on so-called unenumerated rights stemming from the 14th Amendment. And in the last two generations, we've seen quite a few of them, which are immensely popular with American populations. So, you know, one is the right to marry whoever you want, including of a different race. This comes from a case called Loving v. Virginia in the 1960s. You know, then there's the right to birth control. So not just abortion, but birth control itself. That's the Griswold case in the mid-60s. You know, then there's all sorts of other ones of these. There's, of course, the Obergefell decision a few years ago about same-sex marriage. But there's little ones like women with young children who want to work. That's an unenumerated right. That was not something that the founders would have thought about. But that's a case called Phillips from the 70s. Or women's ability to preside over legal documents. This is another one of these. Anything that involves their kids, it would have been something up to the man. But there's case law there from the 70s as well that I teach in class regularly. And students are always shocked to find out that women couldn't preside over their legal documents involving their kids until the 1970s. Particularly the female students in my classes are shocked to hear this news, right? So all of these, there's a long list. I mean, you know, we could probably spend a half hour going through all the unenumerated rights that come from the 14th Amendment that I think, you know, many legal scholars, but certainly historians agree, fit with and are in keeping with the ways in which the 14th Amendment was intended to expand rights and rights protections for individuals, most notably for, you know, newly freed slaves coming out of the Civil War. But extended clearly to, in lots of these examples, to women and others in terms of their own bodily autonomy, their legal autonomy, their ability to marry who they want. And so, you know, it's fairly certain that this is a slippery slope if what we're seeing in the draft becomes the majority opinion.
You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. You can support your local community radio station by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Portland Youth Philharmonic's end-of-season concert. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 57. Today in history, in 1862, troops led by General Ignacio Zaragoza halt a French invasion in the Battle of Puebla in Mexico. It is more widely celebrated in the United States than in Mexico and began in California in 1863. Our quote of the day is from Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, who was born today in 1813. He wrote, quote, "It is perfectly true, as philosophers say, that life must be understood backwards, but they forget the other proposition that it must be lived forwards. Russia targets critical infrastructure in Ukraine. Oklahoma bans abortions after 6 weeks. The Fed hikes interest rates to fight inflation, and the company behind TurboTax agrees to a multi-million dollar settlement. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
We think this is an effort to try to disrupt the Ukrainians' ability to replenish and reinforce themselves.
A Defense Department spokesperson, John Kirby, said Russia is targeting critical infrastructure in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the European Union is mulling a ban on oil imports from Russia and other new sanctions. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer promised a vote to codify abortion rights into federal law. However, West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema still oppose changing filibuster rules, making passage difficult. University of California Irvine Law Professor Michelle Goodwin says the Supreme Court's leaked draft opinion on abortion rights has other implications.
You see the potential for the Supreme Court to do a bit of cherry picking around equality issues, around privacy issues, about matters that relate to autonomy with people's bodies.
Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signed a bill banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. As in Texas, state residents can sue doctors who perform abortions or anyone who aids or abets an abortion. Fed Chair Jerome Powell on Wednesday announced the biggest interest rate hike in 22 years, a 0.5%, after a quarter point jump in March.
It is essential that we bring inflation down if we are to have a sustained period of strong labor market conditions that benefit all.
In a speech from the White House, President Biden called Senate Republican National Senatorial Campaign Committee Chair Rick Scott's platform extreme, adding it would raise taxes on 75 million families making under $100,000 a year.
I don't want to hear Republicans talk about deficits and their ultra-MAGA agenda. I want to hear about fairness. I want to hear about decency.
The Biden administration continues to defend its creation of a disinformation governance board. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the board would help counter messaging used by drug cartels. Republican Kentucky Senator Rand Paul responded.
You think the American people are so stupid they need you to tell them what the truth is? You can't even admit what the truth is with the Steele dossier. I don't trust government to figure out what the truth is.
On Wednesday, New York Attorney General Letitia James announced Intuit, the company behind the TurboTax filing software, will pay $141 million to low-income and military customers who were deceived by promises of free tax filing services. Intuit admitted no wrongdoing, according to a company statement. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Awareness Day is marked across the country. The impending end of Roe versus Wade is part of the observations. And a U.S. House bill could help the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma and farmers in an Illinois land dispute. With these stories more, here's National Native News.
Advocates across the country are holding events this week to raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous people. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent reports.
Last year, Congress designated May 5th a day of awareness for missing and murdered Native women and girls. They face murder rates more than 10 times the national average. Northern Cheyenne member Hannah Harris is one example. Her death inspired the resolution in Congress. The 21-year-old went missing and was found murdered in 2013 on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Montana. May 5th was her birthday. In Colorado, Gina Lopez, a Ute Mountain tribal member, is working with state lawmakers on a bill to create an office for missing and murdered Indigenous people.
I am an adult childhood sexual abuse survivor and survived intimate partner violence as an adult. And these are, unfortunately, experiences that are all too familiar to our communities.
Advocates are using the Day of Awareness to elevate the Colorado bill. The state could join several others in our region that are trying to address this crisis. For National Native News, I'm Robin Vincent.
The possible overturn of Roe versus Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court has weighed heavily on women's rights groups and supporters. This included participants Wednesday at an annual observance of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Springfield, Oregon. University student Samantha Fernandez is of Klamath descent. She says losing abortion rights and access at the federal level would be harsh on an already suffering group that's seen inconsistent health care and disproportionate rates of sexual assault and domestic violence.
For tribal people everywhere is difficult, and they're going to have to seek refuge in other states, and it's just going to make them more vulnerable. It's going to put them in an even tougher position, and being able to protect themselves and speak out for themselves without facing any backlash or anything like that.
The event drew roughly 40 people who heard poetry and remembrances of Native women either killed or who vanished without a trace. The Miami Tribe of Oklahoma would remove any cloud on title to land, about 2.6 acres of farmland in eastern Illinois. In exchange, the tribe seeks a one-year window to bring its case to federal court to seek compensation for the land's transfer and sale without tribal consultation or payment. KNBA's Trip J. Krause reports.
Douglas Langford is chief of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. He spoke before the U.S. House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Indigenous People during a hearing on a number of tribal-related issues.
So all this bill grants to us is our day in court, and we still have to prove our case. But the landowners in Illinois, you know, once it's signed, they receive immediate relief.
Minnesota Democratic Representative Betty McCollum introduced House Resolution 6063 for equitable settlement of certain Indian land disputes regarding land in Illinois. The land was part of an 1805 treaty to the ancestral homelands of the tribe, an area south of the Great Lakes in what are now the states of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. Over time, the United States transferred or sold that land to non-Indians without negotiation or payment to the Miami tribe. Because the tribe says the conveyance happened through treaty-recognized title, it says it's entitled to compensation for the loss. In exchange for the tribe extinguishing the cloud on title, it seeks a one-year window for the tribe to bring its case before the United States Court of Federal Claims. But extinguishing the cloud of title would happen regardless of the tribe's court case.
That's the biggest hurdle, is once the law becomes law, is to take this and go win our case, which we very much intend to do.
For National Native News, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A literacy program can work to mitigate learning loss from pandemic disruption. California is in the bottom five states for school disruptions over the past year, with 96% of its families affected by modifications to in-person learning. Suzanne Potter reports how a program from Save the Children can help make some serious headway.
Literacy programs are making headway against the learning loss associated with the pandemic school disruptions, which put many students 4 to 5 months behind in reading and math. 96% of California students saw in-person classes canceled, modified, or moved online over the prior school year. Close to 40% of the state's enrollment drop was in kindergarten. Dino Pliego with Save the Children in California says the organization's programs serve 15,500 kids at 26 rural schools in the Southland.
Our elementary school age education programs offered during and after school strive for reading and math proficiency by the end of third grade, which is that critical time when children go from learning to read to reading to learn.
The data also show that the school disruptions were harder on some students than others. Children from minority communities were set back an average of 6 months, and those who come from poverty were up to 7 months behind. Shane Garber is head of education, hunger, and resilience for Save the Children. He says the good news is that kids in the literacy programs have proved very resilient.
On average, kids in these programs have gained an additional month in reading above and beyond a full school year's worth of growth. So while much of the country has fallen behind in their reading ability, kids in Save the Children's programs have actually moved ahead, working to close that achievement gap that is persistent across minority and high poverty communities in the rural parts of the United States.
The classes will continue even while school is out to counteract learning loss known as the summer slide. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 5th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Emily Scott, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
While KBOO is currently in its 54th year on the air, which is a long time, that pales in comparison to another local institution, the Portland Youth Philharmonic. Dating back to 1924, PYP is the oldest continuously operating youth orchestra in the country. PYP will be closing their 98th season this Sunday, May 8th at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall with a concert titled April's Song, Nazikinskaya and Saint-Saëns. Here to preview it for us are David Hattner, PYP's musical director, and Katie Liu, winner of PYP's 2021 concerto competition and the 2021 Metro.